Wendy Ring. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. I'm still working one-handed with my wrist in a cast, but instead of doing another summer rerun like I should have done, I'm stretching to cover something which needs action this month. I'm talking about the Farm Bill. Now, even though the Farm Bill is really important, if you're not a bureaucrat or a program recipient, it's also pretty boring. So to keep our eyes open and focused on the prize, we're going to spice up this alphabet soup with plenty of mixed metaphors and stories about actual farmers to illustrate what can happen if we get things right, starting with someone we met back in 2020.
I grew up on a farm. Both of my grandparents farmed. Been involved with agriculture for my entire life.
That's Chris Pravac, cattle farmer, agricultural economist, and extension agent.
I operate two farms with my parents and wife, one in Furman, Alabama, and the other in Stark, Florida. We have about 50 cow-calf pairs and about 300 head of stocker cattle on about 600 acres.
In the beginning, Chris farmed pretty much the same way his grandparents had, but 8 years ago, he started making some big changes.
He stopped plowing his fields, started planting a wider variety of crops, so there's something growing in his pastures year-round, and began moving his grazing stock to a new pasture every day.
With diverse crops keeping the soil covered and providing a home for natural predators of common pests, and with manure fertilizing the forage, he no longer needed feed supplements, herbicides, pesticides, or synthetic fertilizer.
You can see the behavior differences in cattle. They love moving to the next paddock. It's like they're moved to a new buffet every day. I don't have the same crusted, heavy clay soils I had 8-10 years ago. Now, it's very soft. You can grab you a handful. It's more stable. It's a healthy, functioning soil system. Just on our small farm, 600 acres, we're storing enough carbon in our soil for about 850 flights from LAX to JFK.
The transition was expensive. To keep that carbon in the soil, he needed a no-till drill for planting.
I didn't want to drop $50,000, $75,000 on a new piece of equipment. Just kept trying to figure out another way to do it.
To get the money, he sold his conventional farming equipment, so there was no turning back.
We're going to implement something completely new. You have to give up your old ways of doing things. You got to completely, jump off that wagon. You can't go halfway.
Since that time, the ravages of extreme weather have led many farmers and ranchers to consider changing their methods. But most farmers would rather dip in a toe than rip off their overalls and dive in headfirst and butt naked. And they're held back by debt and lack of capital for upfront costs and expenses while they scale the learning curve and wait for new practices to bear fruit. As we predicted back in 2020, soil carbon credits have done more to help climate polluters greenwash their image than provide farmers with income to transition their operations. To get that done, we need a level of government involvement equivalent to FDR's response to the Dust Bowl. The structure established to do that job is still here. It just needs some dusting off and beefing up and a sharper focus on what's most important right now. That's why reducing U.S. agriculture's contribution to the climate crisis hinges on this year's Farm Bill, a massive piece of legislation which comes up every 5 years. If we want to make major cuts in agricultural emissions by 2030 and protect our food supply from increasingly unstable weather, this Farm Bill has to be a turning point. Before we dive, fully clothed, I might add, into what we want in this year's Farm Bill, we've got to start with what we want to keep out of it. Namely, any interference with the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA. The Washington Post recently did a poll about the IRA, which found that 71% of Americans say they know little to nothing about it. I thought I was in the 29% of smarty pants who did know all about it, until I talked to Renata Berlinger, the executive director of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. Her coalition of sustainable agriculture groups lobbies for policies that support climate resilience, something California's farmers and ranchers sorely need.
They're just getting ravaged by disaster after disaster, unprecedented flooding, decades of drought, new pest problems.
Renata says the Inflation Reduction Act is about more than clean energy and helping you swap your furnace for a heat pump.
The Inflation Reduction Act has in it $20 billion over a five-year period for existing Farm Bill programs. It really just inflates hugely the budgets for those programs. All of that money, every single dollar, must be spent on climate beneficial activities. there's a menu of practices that farmers can get grants to do with this new money. It's everything from conserving farmland so cities don't sprawl out onto it, to reducing methane on livestock operations.
These conservation programs already provide incentives for farmers to adopt practices which reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but that's not where most of the money currently goes. Between 2017 and 2020, only 23% of payments in EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, were for practices that mitigate climate change. Last year, two of the top five EQIP practices, and the most expensive by far, supported manure storage at confined animal feeding operations, which actually increase emissions. That's not what the public wants their tax dollars spent on. A national opinion poll earlier this year found that 80% of respondents think we should be incentivizing practices that make agriculture sustainable and resilient. Eric Canraff of the Union of Concerned Scientists Food and Environment Program says these incentives are also extremely popular among farmers.
They're in demand. You know, they're oversubscribed and underfunded.
Last year, three of every four applicants for conservation incentives were turned away for lack of funds. But partisan fighting over the Farm Bill is putting the IRA's funding for agricultural climate solutions in jeopardy.
Right now, that $20 billion, the largest investment since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, is at risk of being cut or the climate focus being taken away. A very small percentage of that money has gone out the door. It was supposed to be distributed over multiple years. And so what the Farm Bill does is it allows those who would like to claw back that money to do so. If Congress were to pass a Farm Bill and not mention the IRA money at all, that money would have to be spent, the $20 billion. What Congress can do is they can also go back and amend what they did in IRA to change that. So that's our fear. I've heard from folks, especially on the House side, Republican members who are wanting to take from that pool of $20 billion and put it towards their other priorities. The House bill is going to come out soon, and it's going to be terrible. It's probably going to destroy the IRA funding and reallocate it towards crop insurance or something else. That's going to happen in the next couple of months, potentially. And then you'll see the Senate bill, which is led by Democrats. And that will probably protect the IRA funding. And then they're going to have to come to some sort of reconciliation or, you know, sort of deal.
Steve Fukugawa grows grapes and tree fruit in California's San Joaquin Valley.
When my father started training me to farm, there were a lot of chemicals and quick solutions to weed control and pest control. And Dad always said that it always bothered him to spray a chemical on the ground to prevent plants from growing. Conventional agriculture has basically sterilized the soil. The San Joaquin Valley that we're in Central California was an ancient ocean with minerals and salts. And as we draw our water table down, the minerals and salts concentrate, as well as all our excess nitrogen we over-fertilize with. And we're trying to irrigate our trees and vines with contaminated water.
Steve got a state grant to put in drip irrigation to minimize his water use, but he also uses climate smart practices that maximize water retention in his soil.
I've used cover crop and compost and more natural approaches.
Including a change of heart about weeds.
When I was a conventional farmer, I always felt that the only good weed is a dead weed. I used to disc everything and keep everything clean. Now my orchard floor is filled with what others would probably say weeds, but I call it cover crop. I plant different species to create biodiversity. And my good plants push my weed plants out.
Steve's combined use of cover crops and compost instead of synthetic fertilizer cuts down on emissions of nitrogen oxide that has 300 times the warming power of carbon dioxide. It's also restored his soil's resilience to drought and heavy rain. Surrounded as he is by conventional farms, Steve can see the difference these practices make compared to what's happening with his neighbors.
Typically in the valley, you run under 1% of soil organic matter. And I recently tested and it's up around 3%. During bloom time, we have to treat the flowers to protect them from damage from fungus. And where other farmers, after a 1-inch rain, can't get out in their fields to protect their crops because the mud that'll get stuck with their spray rigs. But I can get my 600-gallon spray rig out there. The ground is firm and absorbs the water. When I first went organic and let the cover crop and the weeds grow, I got a pest in my vineyard called vine mealybug. Conventional farmers spend thousands of dollars on chemicals to try and control it. But I had a natural predator in my weeds and cover crop that loves to eat vine mealybug. And I've been telling all the farmers every year that I don't have to treat for vine mealybug, and they don't believe me. I like to think that if they see my farm and the success that I have, they'll catch on.
Steve says state and federal funding of climate-focused incentives is essential for farmers like him.
For a small farmer, that's a wish that will never come true unless we receive grants for these things.
A farmer wanting to follow in Steve's footsteps would have an easier time getting federal cost sharing to plant cover crops than she would for applying compost, because the USDA has determined that cover crops are a climate smart practice worthy of funding from the IRA. Compost, for some reason, didn't make it onto that list. Although when I compared the two practices using the online model California and the USDA employed to quantify the carbon impact of these practices, compost removes 7 times more carbon. Another practice not supported by the IRA is making compost from manure.
That practice is not currently funded by the federal government. It is in California, but it's greatly oversubscribed. There's way more producers, 2 or 3 times more than there is money. And of course, no other dairy in the country can participate. There's a guy named Paul Danbaum. He's got about 900 head, and he got an alternative manure management grant a couple years ago, and he installed this equipment that aerates his liquid manure to keep the oxygen moving around, because it's the lack of oxygen that causes methane to be produced. And then he pumps the liquid over to this sort of a conveyor belt screen kind of thing, and it separates the liquids from the solids. The solids drop into this pile, and then he moves it into a compost windrows, these long rows of compost. He mixes it with some of the prunings and waste from his almond fields, because he also has almonds. So he's got feed fields and almond fields, creates this beautiful compost. And then he puts the compost either on his feed fields, which means he doesn't have to put as much synthetic fertilizer, or he'll put it as mulch on his almonds. He is just over the moon about this project. It's done so many beneficial things for him. He's not particularly motivated to cut methane. He's like, yeah, whatever, you know, but in terms of his operations, he's thrilled because there's fewer odors. The whole system is much cleaner, much easier to manage. He's got this incredible product that's saving him money because he's not having to buy as much fertilizer. He's also not spending as much money on water. And then pest problems are reduced because when he puts this mulch down, it creates this habitat for beneficial insects. So he's using less pesticides as well. He thinks he might have cut the inputs of fertilizers and pesticides by close to half. It's really a win across the board. The communities in that area, you know, have cleaner air and water if this was happening on a wide scale. There's just no downside to it. It's expensive, but not as much as a digester, like a third or a fifth or an eighth the cost.
It's still beyond the reach of these dairy farmers, unless government picks up part of the cost.
Dairy producers right now are in very deep trouble financially. The price of milk is far below the cost of production. They're really struggling. They can't afford at this time to take any risks. They can't afford any new equipment.
The Farm Bill is a chance to add some of these practices and to strengthen the USDA's ability to support an agricultural transition. That's where marker bills come in. You're listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. We're talking about climate change and the Farm Bill.
A marker bill is essentially an organizing vehicle, a way for one member of Congress to put out their priorities, and then they can gain co-sponsors. And if you have a marker bill out that has, say, 10 co-sponsors, the likelihood of that being in the farm bill is going to be a lot lower than a bill with, say, 80 co-sponsors. The more support you can show for a marker bill, the more likely it is to be included in the farm bill.
There's a very important marker bill called the Agriculture Resilience Act, ARA.
Representative Pingree introduced it in the House, and then Senator Heinrich introduced a companion bill in the Senate. The companion bill means it's exactly the same bill.
When introducing the bill, Representative Pingree said its goal is to give farmers the tools they need to cut emissions in half by 2030 and reach net zero by 2040.
It is the most comprehensive piece of legislation to address climate change in agriculture that has been introduced to date. It is a science-based roadmap for how agriculture can be a part of the climate solution.
It's really an omnibus bill. It has a tremendous number of programs in there, all of which are designed to reduce emissions on farms and increase resilience. Some of those programs were modeled on what's happened here in California. It would fund dairy operators to install equipment that helps them reduce methane emissions by not flushing the manure out into these big ponds, but instead scraping it and composting it, or moving to more prescribed pasture-based grazing.
Cody Hopkins raises pastured poultry, beef, and hogs in Arkansas. He says raising animals sustainably and humanely means keeping farms to a size that the land can carry. But farmers at that scale need ways to get their products to market and earn the premium price a majority of consumers are now willing to pay for sustainably produced food. That avenue didn't exist, so he created one.
It's either like super tiny, you know, someone selling at a farmer's market, and then you've got the four big meat companies, right? And so we saw an opportunity to create a farmers co-op where we could try to tackle those things together. We launched a joint venture that does poultry processing. At the time, I think there may have been 10 or 12 small USDA certified poultry processing plants in the entire country that would service independent farmers. That was a really pivotal point for our co-op. I don't think we would have made it this far. I know we wouldn't have made it this far if we wouldn't have found that partnership. One of the processors processes for, you know, almost 1,000 farms. And so it can have a really big impact on a community to have that kind of processing in place. Our goal at the end of the day is to make sure we're putting as many dollars as possible back into our farmers' hands and the rural communities we work in, and the processing partners we're working with are working to pay their employees better. We're actually working on a process right now to give processing employees ownership in those businesses. On average, in the industrial ag system, about 14 cents of every dollar goes back to the farmer, and we're giving closer to 50 or 60 cents of every dollar.
The Agricultural Resilience Act includes the development of regional meat processing plants and local and regional distribution networks.
There's a lot of symbiotic relationships that exist on a farm that's diversified versus monocrop. And we've seen the quality of the pastures improving, having diversified farm operations helps really contribute to healing and improving of the land. One thing that we measure is the improvement in the organic matter in the soil. We've seen farms improve from 1.5% up to 3.5% or 4%. If you can increase, you know, an acre of soil's organic matter from, say, 3% to 4%, that one percentage point increase will increase that acre's water holding capacity by 15 to 20,000 gallons.
Farmers with unhealthy soil are increasingly vulnerable to drought and heavy rain. Over the past two decades, claims have tripled for crop loss and inability to plant due to extreme weather. While some Republicans want to divert IRA funds to cover these rising insurance costs, the ARA has a better idea: link insurance subsidies and premium discounts to adoption of practices that foster climate resilience. The ARA also includes a lot of funding for research, because even though we have to act now, there's a lot we still don't know.
Research is a huge part of the ARA. We think the research section of the ARA is the gold standard. It requires the USDA to look at problems from a systems perspective. from farm to table, the whole process, you want to make sure that it can be produced well, it's nutrient dense, that it's going to be sustainable, and that it's accessible to everybody, including low-income communities. So from the seed to the table, you want to make sure that we're looking from a systems-based perspective. That's what the ARA tries to do, is it brings our research into the 21st century.
The best methods for farmers vary by location, climate, crops, soil types, and the condition the land is in to start with. It can vary region by region, county by county, sometimes even field by field.
It is hard to do a one-size-fits-all approach to this or make blanket statements about this or that practice being beneficial or not.
The ARA would strengthen USDA's regional climate hubs, whose mission is to develop and deliver region-specific climate risk assessments and management options.
The climate hubs right now are underfunded, and they are very short-staffed. They have a skeleton crew. As climate change impacts obviously are going to be getting worse, we need more of this type of regionally tailored research.
The ARA increases funding for better tools to predict and measure greenhouse gas impacts.
There is a system in particular at the USDA called the Long-Term Agroecological Research Network, it's LTAR. And that research is critical because it looks at soil over 10, 20, 30 year period, which is sometimes how long we need to measure, is the soil retaining the carbon? And so the Agriculture Resilience Act would provide a permanent authorization for that network and make sure that it receives permanent funding year after year.
The ARA also seeks to address the USDA's long history of racism and disproportionately benefiting big farmers by setting aside 30% of all funds for beginning and socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers.
30% is an ambitious number given the current political climate, but we would like to make sure that equity is being addressed.
That includes farm workers and meat packers.
They are treated as disposable in our current food and farm system. We recently produced a report that looks at farm worker health and did an analysis of how much money is spent on farm worker health. And it is a very small amount. UCS, along with other organizations, just organized and brought up food and farmers to speak on Capitol Hill to share their stories of heat exposure and pesticide exposure. A lot of these farm workers struggle to find shade or access to water. So we've been trying to emphasize to Congress that more research and more support for food and farm workers is essential. They should be on par with farmers in terms of the support they receive in the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill should be for not just farmers, but everybody in the food chain.
Eric says if we want a sustainable and resilient food system, now is the time to speak up.
The current Farm Bill authorities expire on September 30th of this year. We anticipate that what Congress will do is kick the can down the road a little bit to give them some more time. But as the process goes on, as more time passes, it becomes harder and harder to get priorities in there. So if folks want to see the ARA included in the Farm Bill, now is the time to be asking your member of Congress to co-sponsor that bill and ask for the Agriculture Resilience Act to be included in the Farm Bill. Both of those things need to be done. Your hope is that at least some provisions within that marker bill could be copied and pasted into the Farm Bill. I think what's also important to remember is to ask them to protect the IRA money.
U.S. farmers need that $20 billion to reach net zero carbon. It's a lot less than the IRA's $100 billion for electric vehicles, $65 billion for clean energy manufacturing, and $50 billion for energy efficiency, and our future food supply is riding on it.
In the renewable energy sector, we've had like decades of subsidies, whether it's electric cars or I'm about to get an electric water heater installed. I'm getting $3,000 in rebates to do it. It's going to cut my cost at least in half, making it possible for me to do this. Would I have spent twice that much money to do it? I don't know. But eventually, after enough of us do it with that kind of help, those of us who are privileged enough, you know, to be able to make that choice, eventually the market responds. Economies of scale kick in. Things get cheaper. We've seen this with solar panels. It's the same idea with farming. Farming's like so far behind the energy efficiency and renewable energy sector. It's decades behind. And that's what all these programs are meant to do. They're not meant to be permanent subsidies forever and ever. They're really meant to get folks over the hurdle of figuring it out. De-risk a transition, give the producer an opportunity to try something out that they would otherwise maybe be too nervous about because they might take a yield hit, you know, as they figure it out, or they might need some new equipment, or they might have a learning curve. There are risks for all of us, right? If we adopt a new practice, you know, sometimes that can have an economic downside. But 20, 30 years from now, I want to be able to look back and say, yeah, that was money well spent, because now we have these diverse farms with rich soil and we're not using any many chemicals on them. And we're still eating this amazing food and farm workers are safer. Like, that's the vision I think could eventually result from government leadership. This is a transition. That's what gets me up in the morning, is thinking about being at the forefront of that kind of a massive transition in a huge industry with so many positives in the end for everybody.
Thanks for joining us for Cool Solutions, Stories of Climate Action from the Bottom Up. You'll find links to take action at our website, cool-solutions.org. And while you're communicating with legislators, here's some other farm marker bills you might want to support. The Justice for Black Farmers Act, which addresses generations of USDA discrimination and land theft from Black farmers. The Farm Systems Reform Act, which cracks down on big meat monopolies and puts a moratorium on factory farms. The EQIP Improvement Act, which would open up the program to more farmers by capping the amount individuals can receive, limiting support for practices with little or no environmental benefit, and removing that 50% set aside for livestock. Thank you to Chris Privat, Renata Brillinger, Eric Kamrath, and Steve Fukugawa, and to Scott Holmes, Jason Shaw, Lobo Loco, Marissa Anderson, and One Man Book for our music.